This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. 10 years ago this week, American military forces invaded Iraq. It was a lightning-quick military operation that pushed from the Kuwaiti border all the way to Baghdad and quickly toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein. A regional bully was finished, and the hope of a Western-style democracy in the heart of Arabia was born. Then things got complicated, messy, and very, very deadly.
Nearly 4,500 American soldiers and Marines died in Iraq. Tens of thousands more were wounded and scarred for life. The precise number of Iraqi casualties is unknown, but certainly well above 100,000 killed in a long war and occupation that cost the United States close to $3 trillion.
So 10 years later, what are the lessons of that war? To what extent does the shadow of the U.S. war in Iraq still hang over the entire region and affect American policy there? Ron Suskind has thought a lot about those questions. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The 1% Doctrine and The Way of the World, among other books. He's a senior scholar at Harvard Center for Ethics. And Ron Suskind, welcome to Radio Boston, and welcome back to WBUR, by the way. It feels like old times.
It's great to be here, Anthony. How many, 20 years ago was it? I don't want to age you here, Tony, but I did commentaries here when I lived up here.
A little while ago. Anyway, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
So let's go back to February 8th, 2004. The long occupation is well underway, but it was clear even then that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which had been at the heart of President George W. Bush's case for war. So NBC's Tim Russert had a chance to ask this question of the president.
Do you believe the war in Iraq is a war of choice or a war of necessity?
I think that's an interesting question. Please elaborate on that a little bit. A war of choice or a war of necessity? I mean, it's a war of necessity.
So, Ron, a war of choice, a war of necessity. What's the answer to that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You hear George Bush fumfering there. That was the key framing by Russert. And I kind of miss Russert, I have to say. He was as close as we had to a kind of Walter Cronkite of that period. You know, how to frame this war. And in fact, it was really more, looking back, a war of will. The will of this president and his vice president and the people around him, Bush and Cheney and the others, from the very first National Security Council meeting of the Bush presidency in January of 2001, the question was how to invade Iraq, how to justify it. As Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, said famously in one of my books, it was just a matter of how do we do this? Find me a way to do this. And throughout the presidency, before 9/11, and certainly after, it was a matter simply of finding a way to justify what was their will, even though actually they were rather succinct and not alone, but isolated in feeling that Iraq was the key issue.
And I want to talk to you about this very issue because, as we all know, the Bush administration made a case that this war had to be fought because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He had used them before, gassed his own people, and we simply couldn't take the risk that he would use them again, possibly against us. But in your book, The Way of the World, you talk about back-channel communications before the war, in the lead-up to the war, between members of the Bush administration and the former foreign minister and intelligence chief of Iraq. That's Naji Sabri and Tahir Habush. What did they tell the administration? What did you learn that they told the administration?
They were quite succinct, and they were operating essentially as intelligence assets for us at that point. There was money being exchanged, and they were telling us things that we knew Saddam Hussein wouldn't want them to tell us. And essentially, it was that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And importantly, the mind of Saddam Hussein was such that he couldn't understand why the U.S. would want to invade Iraq. He didn't think they were for real, that the U.S. aggression was for real. And more, they said he's worried about his neighbors in the region, especially the Iranians, discovering that he has no weapons of mass destruction. That was Saddam's fear, which explains a lot of his odd behavior in the run-up to the war. This was briefed to the president well in advance, certainly by January, February of 2003, 2-3 months prior to the invasion.
So this was intelligence that suggested this whole basis upon which the case for war was being made. was not so. How did the administration respond to this?
Well, the administration responded, this is the last thing we want to hear. Even inside of CIA, prior to this briefing being offered to the president, someone said, George Tenet said, they're not going to like this downtown, downtown meaning the White House, because I think it's important to step back and understand that Cheney and others didn't believe the U.S. needed to even make a case for this invasion. They felt the powers of the presidency in guiding foreign policy were such that the president could make this decision essentially unilaterally. This was in the national interest of the United States, and we will move forward as such. Cheney, of course, was against Colin Powell having to go in front of the UN. He says, we shouldn't have to make a case. Bush decided that we would make a case. And then it was a matter of essentially marketing and advertising, how to fashion something that could be sold as a rationale for war. And ultimately, it shows itself to be hollow soon enough.
And yet, there are some who would say, and continue to say today, that this all comes with the benefit of hindsight. That is, while Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction, it wasn't ludicrous to suppose that he did. And if he did, was that a risk worth taking?
It's interesting. From the very start, a year prior to the invasion, there were intelligence communities inside of the U.S., heads of the various agencies got together with the president. The president set up a one-year ticking clock. We will invade Iraq in 1 year. This is from January of 2002. We invade, obviously, in March of 2003. And at the very start, they said, look, if we're going to base this case on weapons of mass destruction, we may get there and find there are none. Even if there are some now, Saddam may make them unfindable if there are forces crossing his country, U.S. forces. And so Bush understood from the beginning that this might be a very thin case and there may not be weapons. But I think it's important to understand that, as Cheney says in the famous 1% doctrine, it's not about evidence. It's about response. And the view was, after 9/11, this was the way the U.S. needed to respond to show its might, to show it was unbowed, to show it could do what it wanted to do for whatever reason, good, bad, or unspoken.
And yet, what's the lesson here? Because it seems like in the lead up to this war, in the final analysis, looking back, the American people never had the opportunity to really consider all of the information.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, this whole framing of war of choice versus war of necessity, Bush says war of necessity. Obviously, Russert is saying more war of choice, but the American people were never really given a choice. They were never offered the opportunity that, frankly, most leaders would dare not abrogate, to say here are the reasons for war. Even dictators hesitate to send their young people into war without a just cause. In this case, that was never offered. I mean, if people wonder what was the big geopolitical idea here, and I think the issues for Iraq are both geopolitical and Oedipal in some ways, because Bush had very complex relations with his father's unfinished business, what he would carry forward. But geopolitically, the view was that weapons of mass destruction can now be attained by people of all stripes, rogue states, dictators, because they're carried on civil technology. You can't stop it. And the U.S. doesn't really have a response to this, even though folks getting WMD, like the Iranians, for instance, will deny us opportunities in many regions of the world. So the concept was that Saddam Hussein was kind of a easy mark. The intelligence showed he was weakened. He was being conned by his own people, his own key aides. And so if we make a demonstration model of him, an example of him, it might deter other leaders from challenging the United States, especially in terms of getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction. That was actually the rationale, essentially to do a behavioral experiment using Saddam Hussein to shape the behavior of other rogue states around the world. And some psychologist friend of mine says, you know, sometimes these behavioral experiments don't work with three people in a locked room. Here they're doing it on the whole globe. But that was the idea.
This idea of using this war to make an example, it's such an interesting idea. And it's an idea that the Bush administration pushes, as you point out. But it's also an idea that a lot of folks seem willing to embrace. So I want to go back and play another piece of tape. This is also from 2004. Here's New York Times columnist Tom Friedman telling Charlie Rose that while there were some difficulties with the piece, those were his words, people in that part of the world had to be taught a lesson that backing terrorism was wrong. Here's what he said.
And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house, from Basra to Baghdad, and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this. Okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could.
We hit Iraq because we could. So statements like that were indicative of a nation that was really gripped by this fever-like enthusiasm for this war. And while it was pushed hard by the Bush administration, it was also supported overwhelmingly by Americans. Polls showed they supported it 2-1 leading up to the war. What explained that, do you think?
I think it's human nature. We were struck. We felt disempowered. And we wanted to show our might, our ability to express ourselves, if you will, that America can do what it wants when it wants to do it. And it can reshape the globe as it sees fit. Again, unilaterally, this notion of preemptive war certainly came up in this period.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of this notion of war of will. George Bush was willful. That was his character. That was the way he was since he was a kid, as his mother and father would tell you. He was, in a way, an ideal president to kind of harness and tap a willfulness that gripped the American people at a time of real suffering, a time of pain and doubt in the country.
So what's the legacy of this long decade of war? First, for the U.S., how does it affect our position in the region and how we're viewed there?
You know, it's interesting because there were some yields right along the lines of what we're talking about, what I think Friedman says. I think that's a very hard comment to hear Friedman offer, but it's one that was indicative of the sensations that Americans felt. One of the things that's surprising that the intelligence community still talks about, of the great opportunity that was missed along these lines of WMD, is that when we had 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, who were spooked by this, upset, were the Iranians, who are the real power in the region. They essentially crawled on broken glass over to us and said, we're ready to deal. We can help you with the folks in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We know them intimately, of course, if you need intelligence. And even we can talk about issues of WMD for Iran. Dick Cheney took control of that
former
conversation.
Former defense secretary.
Well, at that point, the vice president.
The vice president.
And
right.
Cheney essentially says, real men go to Tehran. We do not negotiate with evil. Which is how he viewed the Iranians. And an enormous opportunity was missed, which, of course, we're paying the debt for now with the Iranians and their WMD program and essentially assertion of Iran as the key actor in the area.
And what about Iraq? Just this week, a wave of car bombings and other attacks in Baghdad killed more than 50 people, so still remains very unstable there. On the other hand, Saddam Hussein's dictatorship is gone, supporters of the war would say, and they still do. It's messy. It was messy, but better off today than with Saddam Hussein.
Look, you know, there were opportunities in the run-up to war, especially with these intelligence sources, the foreign minister and the intelligence chief, to kill Saddam Hussein in a coup by organizing the two of them. Had that been done, it would have been almost identical to the situation we have now. Now, certainly people would say that Iran is a failed state. I think it's not quite that. They do have the foundations of democracy laid. The battle between, you know, Alawi and Maliki is a democratic struggle. And I think the question of its legacy will go forward as to what Iraq looks like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. But in terms of the predicates for war, I think it is a rather unique example in American history where essentially the cause for war was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the evidence clearly shows a willful lie, a matter of marketing and advertising rather than evidence. And I think that really has a kind of a hard echo moving forward. People who work in this region, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, say the difference was prior to this war, the U.S. was really seen as different. You know, kind of the good guys. We do things for clear reasons that are clearly announced and clearly defendable. Now we're sort of seen as like everybody else. We essentially move forward and use our power for reasons to expand and extend our power rather than for higher principle.
So here we are, 10 years later, 100,000-plus Iraqis dead, along with 4,500 Americans, $3 trillion spent. Are you surprised that none, given what you said about a willful lie, is it surprising at all that none of the major architects of the war, from George W. Bush to Vice President Dick Cheney, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, all these people, not one of them has come forward and said, yeah, we made a mistake. We were wrong.
Well, you know, you hear it in their comments periodically where they said, well, it would have been interesting had we known X, Y, and Z, which, of course, the evidence shows they did know. That's a way of discussing a kind of hypothetical that actually, I think, in the long span of history, will be shown to be solid and truthful. It takes often decades, often in the lifetime of the actors. These things do not get solved or come to a kind of a clarity on history's ledger. They'll go to their graves denying it. Mm. And Nixon was very much like that, too. But I think now it's clear, as the evidence, aggregates and coalesces, that history's judgments are coming into focus.
Ron Suskind is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's author of The 1% Solution and The Way of the World, among other books. He's also a senior scholar at Harvard Center for Ethics. Ron Suskind, great pleasure to have you. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure.
Still ahead, Bill Littlefield on Dominican Pride and the World Baseball Classic. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.